Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 19th, 2021 Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy. Today I'll be reading the following main articles. Elijah McClain, Aurora to pay $15 million, by Elise Schmelzer of the Denver Post. Cherry Creek West, Transformative Project Unveiled, by Judith Kohler of the Denver Post. And House Moves Toward OK of Dems Sweeping Bill, by Alan Fram of the Associated Press. And I'll be following up with miscellaneous articles. Our lead story, Elijah McClain, Aurora to pay $15 million, settlement with parents over 2019 death, likely largest in state history, by Elise Schmelzer. Aurora has agreed to pay $15 million to the parents of Elijah McClain to settle the civil rights lawsuit they filed against the city in the wake of the 23-year-old's 2019 death after a violent arrest, a source with knowledge of the settlement confirmed Thursday. The settlement is likely the largest police misconduct settlement in Colorado history and among the largest ever in the United States. McClain's mother, Shanine, on Thursday thanked the community for its commitment to ensuring her son's death would lead to reform. His death left a void in her life, she said in a statement released by her attorneys at Raythad Mohammadbai. While nothing will fill that void, Ms. McClain is hopeful that badly needed reforms to the Aurora Police Department will spare other parents the same heartache, the statement said. The $15 million payment was agreed upon in July, but the settlement has not been finalized as McClain's parents are negotiating how much each should receive, court documents show. A court hearing on the agreement is scheduled for 10:30 a.m. Friday. The source spoke to the Denver Post on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly before the settlement is finalized. Aurora City officials and lawyers for McClain's parents previously had acknowledged that a tentative settlement had been reached, but they had not divulged the dollar figure. CBS Denver was the first to report the amount of the settlement. Emails between an Aurora city attorney and lawyers for McClain's parents show that the city grew impatient with the length of time it was taking to finalize the settlement. The disagreement between the parents, quote, should not hold the city and other named defendants hostage in keeping a case open that has been resolved, Isabel Evans, a litigation manager for Aurora, wrote in a September 27th email. Aurora's public liability insurance will pay for some, but not all, of the cost of the settlement. The city's insurance in 2019 capped payments for police-related claims at $10 million, leaving the city on the hook for approximately $5 million of the settlement, which will be paid out of Aurora's general fund. The premium cost for Aurora's public liability insurance has increased over the past 2 years because of market trends and an increase in use of force lawsuits, the Aurora Sentinel has reported. The city paid $399,509 in premiums in 2020 and $1.7 million in 2021, according to data provided by a city spokesman. The lawsuit, filed in August 2020, said Aurora police officers never should have stopped McClain, they never should have tackled and choked him, and paramedics never should have injected him with the sedative ketamine or used such a large dosage. An investigation by a panel of experts hired by the city to review McLean's death made similar findings. Aurora police officers stopped McLean on August 24, 2019, after a report of a suspicious person. The officers detained McLean, violently forced him to the ground, and handcuffed him before a paramedic injected McLean with ketamine. McLean suffered cardiac arrest on the way to the hospital, where he was later declared brain dead. He died August 30th. McLean's death drew little attention beyond Aurora and local media outlets until racial justice protests in summer 2020, after the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer, drew international attention to his death. Since those protests, the Colorado Attorney General began a criminal investigation into the men involved in McLean's death and launched an overall investigation into the Aurora Police Department. Aurora City government officials also paid for an independent investigation into McLean's death, as well as an analysis of the department's policies and practices. A grand jury in September indicted five of the men involved in McLean's death: Aurora police officers Nathan Woodyard and Randy Rodema, former officer Jason Rosenblatt, and paramedics Jeremy Cooper and Lieutenant Peter Sichuniak on 32 combined charges, including manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. State Attorney General Phil Weiser on Tuesday announced the terms of a consent decree negotiated with Aurora City leaders that legally will require the police and fire departments to make specific reforms. Some of the required reforms are related to issues identified in investigations into McLean's death, such as the use of ketamine and illegal stops. The $15 million settlement is among the largest police misconduct settlement in the United States. The family of George Floyd received a $27 million settlement, which the family's attorney said was the largest pre-trial civil rights settlement in the U.S. Breonna Taylor's family received $12 million after police in Louisville, Kentucky, shot and killed her. The family of Michael Brown won a $1.5 million settlement after police in Ferguson, Missouri killed him. The settlement is likely the largest in a Colorado civil rights claim against police. North Glen paid $9 million to two women who were shot by an officer. Denver paid $4.6 million to the family of Michael Marshall and $6 million to the family of Marvin Booker. Both men died in the Denver jail. Cherry Creek West: transformative project unveiled. East-West Partners announces redevelopment plans for 13 acres west of shopping center, by Judith Kohler. The land just west of the Cherry Creek Shopping Center is in store for a major makeover. East-West Partners, a longtime Colorado developer whose projects include Denver's Riverfront Park and the redevelopment of the Union Station neighborhood in Lower Downtown, said Thursday that it is launching a transformative redevelopment of the site over the next several years. The Buell Foundation and Taubman Realty Group, the owners of the land and the Cherry Creek Shopping Center, are key collaborators and will be involved in the planning, East-West Partners said Thursday. The project, called Cherry Creek West, will stretch from University Boulevard on the east to Clayton Street and from First Avenue on the north to the Cherry Creek Waterway. Amy Kara, managing partner of East-West Partners, said the goal is to create a neighborhood that includes living and workspaces while connecting the Cherry Creek area to its namesake, the creek that runs along the south side of the property. "This is a site we've had a lot of interest in because it's really the gateway to Cherry Creek," Kara said. The west side of the area, however, wasn't meeting the potential of the rest of what Cherry Creek can be, she added. The 1.3 million square foot shopping center has about 160 stores and 40 eateries. Stores include Nordstrom, Macy's, Louis Vuitton, Neiman Marcus, and the North Face. The 13-acre west portion of the property consists of parking lots and mostly vacant buildings. The planning is in the early stages, but East-West Partners' vision is to create a place where people can live, work, and spend time. We intend to have significant residential space there, significant office space. It's possible there could be a hotel. It's possible there could be senior living, Kara said. We will have some retail there, but it's not designed to be competitive with what's in the shopping center or what's in Cherry Creek North, but instead to be additive. Plans include creating a green open space with a public amphitheater that connects the Cherry Creek North retail area and the shopping center to the creek. Kara said a rough estimate of the project's value is $1 billion. The first phase of work could be completed in about 5 years. Kara said East-West Partners has been talking to Taubman about the proposal since 2015, and in earnest with Taubman and the Buell Foundation since 2019. She expects the city to begin its detailed review of the plan and new zoning for the property in early December. We have been considering the redevelopment of this site for many years now. The Cherry Creek West project aligns with our long-term goals of integrating the mall and the West End property further into the fabric of the community, Bill Salioet, director of development for Taubman, said in an email. East-West Partners will lease the land from the Buell Foundation. The project will be a wondrous addition to the Denver market and generate significant value for the foundation and its mission to support early childhood health, education, and development, Tom McGonigal, a foundation board member, said in a statement. East-West Partners said it will reach out to the community and provide information on a website, cherrycreekwest.com. Kara said the firm will seek input from residents and business leaders and use the website to post updates and links to the city's meetings and decisions. And Kara said the developers will work with their traffic engineers and the Denver Department of Transportation and Infrastructure to minimize the impacts from traffic and construction. East-West Partners is working with Denver-based Design Workshop and Gensler, a design and architecture firm, on the plan. The late Temple Buell, a nationally known architect and Denver resident, designed and developed the original Cherry Creek Shopping Center, one of the country's first major malls. When the renovated shopping center opened in 1990, some people predicted a mall focused on fashion and luxury items would fail in Denver. William Taubman, chief operating officer of his family's company, told the Denver Post in a 2018 interview. At the time, Bed Bath & Beyond recently had left its location on the west side of the shopping center. That is part of a larger program for us to understand really what we want to do with the entire west end of the shopping center, Taubman said during the interview. I think there is an opportunity to densify the west end. We need to understand what that means right now. In 2020, Simon Property Group, the largest mall operator in the U.S., struck a $3.6 billion deal for an 80% interest in Taubman Centers Incorporated. House moves toward okay of Dems sweeping bill by Alan Fram. Dateline, Washington. Democrats brushed aside months-long divisions and approached House passage of their expansive social and environment bill early Friday, as President Joe Biden and his party neared a defining win in their drive to use their control of government to funnel its resources toward their domestic priorities. House approval, which Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy held up with an hours-long speech, was still expected on a near-party line vote. That would send the measure to a Senate, where cost-cutting demands by moderate Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, and that chamber's strict rules seemed certain to force significant changes. That will prompt fresh disputes between party centrists and moderates that will likely take weeks to resolve. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said the bill would worsen federal deficits by $160 billion over the coming decade. It also recalculated the measure's 10-year price tag at $1.68 trillion, although that figure was not directly comparable to a $1.85 trillion figure Democrats have been using. The 2,100-page bill's initiatives include bolstering child care assistance, creating free preschool, curbing seniors' prescription drug costs, and beefing up efforts to slow climate change. Too many Americans are just barely getting by in our economy, said House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, a Democrat from Maryland, and we simply can't go back to the way things were before the pandemic. Final passage was delayed indefinitely as McCarthy, a Republican from California, spoke for more than 2 hours criticizing the legislation, Biden, and the Democrats. Democrats sporadically booed and groaned, and McCarthy glared back, underscoring partisan hostility only deepened by this week's censure of Representative Paul Gosar, an Arizona Republican, for threatening tweets aimed at Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a New York Democrat. McCarthy, who hopes to become Speaker if Republicans capture the chamber in next year's elections, recited problems the country has faced under Biden, including inflation, large numbers of immigrants crossing the southwest border, and the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. "Yeah, I want to go back," he said, in mocking reference to the Build Back Better name that Biden uses for the legislation. House rules do not limit how long party leaders may speak. In 2018, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a California Democrat, who was minority leader at the time, held the floor for over 8 hours demanding action on immigration. Key estimates of the bill's costs by the nonpartisan CBO aligned closely with earlier figures from the White House. That included tax credits to spur clean energy development, bolstered child care assistance, and extended tax breaks for millions of families with children, lower-earning workers, and people buying private health insurance. The measure would provide $109 billion to create free preschool for 3- and 4-year-olds. There were large sums for home health care for seniors, new Medicare coverage for hearing, and a new requirement for 4 weeks of paid family leave. The family leave program, however, was expected to be removed in the Senate, where it's opposed by Manchin. In one major but expected difference, CBO estimated that by spending $80 billion to beef up IRS tax enforcement, the agency would collect $207 billion in new revenue over the coming decade. That meant net savings of $127 billion, well below the White House's more optimistic $400 billion estimate. In a scorekeeping quirk, the CBO formally estimated that the legislation would drive up federal budget deficits by $367 billion over the coming decade. The agency's budget guidelines technically require it not to count IRS savings when measuring a bill's deficit impact, but it acknowledged that the measure's true impact would produce added shortfalls of the lower figure, $160 billion, when counting added revenue that the IRS would collect. Biden and other Democratic leaders have said the measure would pay for itself, largely through tax increases on the wealthy, big corporations, and companies doing business abroad. Republicans said the legislation would damage an economy racked by inflation, give tax breaks to some wealthy taxpayers, and make government bigger and more intrusive. Drawing frequent GOP attacks was a provision boosting the limit on state and local taxes that people can deduct from federal taxes, which disproportionately helps top earners from high-tax coastal states. 2 weeks after centrist objections forced Democrats to delay the measure, the party's division seemed all but resolved for now. Facing uniform Republican opposition, Democrats can lose no more than 3 votes to prevail in the House. In a significant sign of movement, Florida Democratic Representative Stephanie Murphy, a leading House centrist, said she would back the measure after the latest budget figures persuaded her that the legislation is fiscally disciplined. She said the bill is flawed but has a lot of positive elements. Biden this week signed a $1 trillion package of highway and other infrastructure projects, which he has spent recent days promoting around the country. But he has been battered recently by falling approval numbers in polls, reflecting voters' concerns over inflation, supply chain delays, and the persistent pandemic. After months of talks, Democrats appeared eager to wrap it up, shelving lingering differences to begin selling the package back home. House Democrats said they were planning 1,000 events across the country by year's end to pitch the measure's benefits to voters. They face 2022 midterm elections in which Republicans have strong hopes for capturing control of both the House and the Senate. House passage of the social and environment bill would send it to the 50-50 Senate, where Democrats have 0 votes to spare. That has given enormous leverage to Manchin. Senate talks could take weeks, and the prospect that Manchin or others will force additional cuts in the measure was making it easier for House moderates to back the legislation Thursday. The altered bill would have to return to the House before going to Biden's desk. When moderates delayed House passage of the bill 2 weeks ago, they said they wanted to make sure the CBO's projections for its costs were similar to White House numbers, which showed the measure essentially paid for itself. But some moderates said projections about IRS savings are always uncertain and would not cause them to oppose the measure. Others said the measure's $555 billion in tax credits and other costs to encourage cleaner energy need not be paid for in the bill because global warming is an existential crisis. CBO estimated that language helping the government curb prescription drug cost would save $297 billion over 10 years. The savings would come from new constraints on pharmaceutical companies' pricing, but also by blocking a rule on drug company rebates that was initiated by President Donald Trump but never took effect. The bill also would let the government issue work permits to millions of immigrants that would let them stay in the U.S. temporarily. That seemed likely to be changed or eliminated in the Senate, where rules limit provisions allowed in budget bills. The Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, which preaches fiscal constraint, estimated that the bill's overall cost would be nearly $5 trillion if Democrats had not made some of its programs temporary. For example, tax credits for children and low-earning workers, top party priorities, are extended for just 1 year, making their price tags appear lower, even though the party would like those programs to be permanent. Moving to the Denver and the West section, Biden picks Becker as EPA administrator. President Joe Biden has chosen Boulder's K.C. Becker, the recent Speaker of the Colorado House of House of Representatives for a top job in the Environmental Protection Agency. In a news release Thursday, the White House announced Biden intends to appoint Becker to be administrator of the EPA's Region 8, which covers Colorado, Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Utah, Wyoming, and 28 tribal nations. Becker, a Democrat, exited the legislature after being term limited in 2020. She represented Boulder in the state house, ascending to the speakership for her final 2 years at the Capitol. While a legislator, Becker was known for work on aggressive climate action policies, including the landmark 2019 state law meant to overhaul regulation of the state's oil and gas industry. Becker is an attorney who worked for nearly 7 years as an attorney advisor in the solicitor's office at the U.S. Department of the Interior. Eldora opens Friday despite limited snow this season. Despite limited snowfall so far this season, Eldora will open for alpine skiing and riding Friday with one lift and one run. Eldora officials in an email said the Alpenglow high-speed six-person chair would be operational and one intermediate run, Hornblower Trail to International Trail, would be open. No beginner terrain or freestyle park terrain will be available on opening day or this weekend. While natural snowfall has been light and our initial terrain offerings are quite limited, we're thrilled to open for another great season of skiing and riding and to provide our loyal guests with an opportunity to spend time outdoors in this beautiful place, doing what they love with friends and family, Brent Trigaskis, Eldora's president and general manager, said. Masks are not required outdoors, but are required indoors as part of Boulder County's mask policy. With limited terrain, visitors are warned to expect busy slopes. Weekend and holiday parking also is expected to be limited, and single occupancy vehicles will be charged a $10 fee at those times. GAO says relocation of BLM left high vacancy rates hurt diversity, by Michael D. Shear of the New York Times. Dateline Washington. A decision by the Trump administration to move the headquarters of the Bureau of Land Management to Grand Junction from Washington left the agency with high vacancy rates as veteran employees, especially African Americans, quit rather than relocate, a government watchdog said in a report issued this week. Senior officials at the Interior Department under President Donald Trump had argued that the move was needed to ensure that top employees were closer to the federal land that the agency manages, most of which is in the western half of the United States. But the report from the Government Accountability Office was critical of the decision, saying that the agency lacked a strategic workforce plan that could have guided its decision-making. As a result, the report found, the move caused many staff members to quit rather than relocate to Colorado. Out of a total staff of about 560 people, 134 people left the Bureau of Land Management after the move was announced in 2019. Of those remaining at the BLM, 176 were asked to relocate, but 135 refused. The report, which was reported earlier by the Washington Post, said other decisions at the agency at the same time, such as changes to its organizational structure, led to additional departures and an increased reliance on details or employees from other agencies who are assigned temporarily to perform the duties of a position that has been vacated. The result, the report said, was a loss of headquarters workers, increased numbers of headquarters vacancies, a loss of experienced workers, and decreased representations of employees of some races and ethnicities. Increased vacancies and the details used to temporarily fill those vacancies sometimes led to confusion and inefficiency. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced in September that she had decided to reverse the Trump administration's decision to move the BLM's headquarters. But Representative Raul M. Grijalva, a Democrat from Arizona, chairman of the House Committee on Natural Resources, had requested the GAO's report. He asked the Accountability Office to examine changes in the Bureau's workforce after the decision by the Trump administration. The authors of the report said it was difficult to assess the full effect of the move and other changes at the 8,800-person agency because officials did not maintain comprehensive data about vacancies and other personnel issues. The report said there was only a minor change in the racial and ethnic makeup of the overall agency after the relocation of its headquarters. Before the move, about 83% of the Bureau's employees were white, about 8% were Latino, about 3.3% were Black, and the rest were Native American, Asian, or other. After the change, the makeup was 80% white, 9.5% Latino, 3.1% Black, and a slightly larger share for other racial and ethnic groups. But the report found that the changes in the racial makeup of the headquarters staff was much more significant. Black employees made up more than 21% of the staff at the BLM headquarters, perhaps reflecting the population of Washington, D.C., which is about 45% Black, according to the 2019 census. After the move to Colorado, the racial makeup was different, the report said. By January 2021, after the relocation was completed, the number of Black or African American headquarters workers decreased by more than half, making up 12% of total headquarters workers, the report said. The authors urged the BLM to more closely track vacancies throughout its workforce to allow them to better understand the effects of decisions by its leadership. They also recommended that the agency's senior officials create a strategic plan to guide them on future changes to its personnel. BLM does not have complete and reliable data on vacancies and details, and therefore does not have a complete picture of its staffing needs, the report concluded. Without such data on vacancies and details across the agency, BLM officials do not have complete information to make decisions about filling vacancies and initiating details to help the agency achieve its mission and goals. Bureau officials said in response to the report that they intended to make those changes. Moving forward, the BLM intends to establish a more standardized process to track vacancies and detailees bureau-wide, said Laura Daniel Davis, the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Land and Minerals Management, wrote in the agency's response. She added that the agency was currently in the process of developing a process for bureau-wide strategic workforce planning. Man arrested in missing girl case by Daniel Boniface and Kieran Nicholson of the Denver Post. Westminster police on Wednesday arrested a 30-year-old man on suspicion of sexual assault in connection with the case of an 11-year-old girl who went missing overnight Tuesday. A tip from a construction worker in the neighborhood where she went missing led investigators to find the girl and arrest the suspect. Michael Patrick Buckley was arrested on a charge of sexual assault on a child as part of a pattern of abuse, police announced Thursday in a blog post. The girl was reported missing Tuesday evening after telling her mother she was going to a nearby park and failing to return home. She was found Wednesday after a public tip led investigators to her, police said. A construction worker at a home in the area told investigators that the girl approached him about 3:15 p.m. Tuesday and asked to use his cell phone so she could call her boyfriend, according to an arrest affidavit in the case. The girl had to make a second call, calling the same number, and she told the worker that her boyfriend was 5 minutes away. The girl claimed to be 23, and she told the worker she had met her boyfriend on Craigslist, which he was using to sell rats, according to the affidavit. The concerned worker saw a silver Acura with a Colorado license plate pull up, and the girl got into the front passenger seat. The worker took photos of the car, including the license plate. The worker got a good look at the driver and noticed he was missing a pinky finger, according to the affidavit. The construction worker, through the homeowner for whom he's working, contacted police on Wednesday after the worker saw the Amber Alert and photos of the missing girl. Investigators used the license plate of the vehicle to track it to Buckley. When officers knocked at his front door, Buckley, who police said is missing a pinky, answered, according to the affidavit. Police found the girl was inside the residence and arrested Buckley. On Thursday morning, Buckley was being held without bail at the Jefferson County Jail. He has a court hearing scheduled for next Wednesday. Kruger Rock Fire is 60% contained, by Kieran Nicholson of the Denver Post. The Kruger Rock Fire, which has burned 146 acres southeast of Estes Park, is 60% contained, according to firefighters. The fire, which started early Tuesday, had minimal growth Thursday, according to a U.S. Forest Service news release. A red flag warning for extreme fire danger because of very dry weather with single-digit humidity and strong winds is in effect for the area through 5 a.m. Friday, according to the National Weather Service. Overnight winds Thursday could gust up 40 miles per hour. Firefighters on Thursday built and secured firebreak hand lines, the Forest Service said. More than 200 firefighters are battling the fire, which was creeping and smoldering on Thursday. Below freezing temperatures overnight helped the fire to lay down. No aircraft were used Thursday to fight the fire. On Tuesday, a pilot for CO Fire Aviation, a Fort Morgan company, died when his plane crashed while fighting the fire. Mark Thor Olson was an Army and Air Force veteran pilot using a novel nighttime technique when the crash happened. Aircraft will be available Friday to support ground crews if weather conditions allow, the Forest Service said. Firefighters have been patrolling and monitoring the fire. The fire was reported at about 5:50 a.m. Tuesday near Little Valley and Fish Creek Roads. It was sparked when strong winds toppled a tree, which downed a power line. No structure damage has been reported. An area on the north side of the fire, along North St. Vrain Avenue, remains under mandatory evacuation. And we have some obituaries, so I will read the basics from those. Gilda Sandy Massey Taylor, born September 20th, 1949, and died November 12th, 2021. Gilda was a credit manager. Her last wishes were that there be no services or a funeral. In lieu of flowers, a donation to American Cancer Society in memory of Gilda is requested. Isla Prouty Gable Venerable Adams of Denver, Colorado, passed away in her home November 14, 2021. She was born November 6, 1936. Isla is preceded in death by her mother, Elva Y. Adams, and father, Winfred Prouty, sister, Jan Vale, and husbands, Bill Adams and Cliff Venerable. Survived by brothers Roy Knight and Jerry Knaub, sister, Peggy Knight, husband, John Gable, daughters Kim and Colette, son Bill, grandchildren Derek and Spencer, and great-granddaughter Sadie. A life celebration will be held at Stony Brook Clubhouse on South Yosemite in Denver, Friday, November 19th at 2 p.m. Richard Eugene Thorpe, born January 14, 1937, and died November 17, 2021, son of Eugene and Wilma Thorpe, Richard was a prize-winning nature photographer. His career started at Martin Marietta on the Apollo project and ended at Ainsworth Balances. Richard is survived by his loving wife of 54 years, Patricia, his sons William, Brian, and his four grandchildren. Services are on Monday, November 22nd at 10 a.m. at Mother of God Catholic Church in Denver. Burial to happen at a later date at Grand Lake Cemetery in Grand Lake, Colorado. Switching back to local news, grant to help create algorithms that promote fairness by Mackenzie Eldred, special to the Daily Camera. Dateline Boulder, a new University of Colorado study funded with a three-year, $930,000 grant from the National Science Foundation, aims to make algorithms used to make recommendations more fair. The study will look at recommender systems, which are personalized access systems that recommend items to individuals, and ways to make the systems more fair to reduce disadvantages and biases. Robin Burke, CU professor and chief of the Information Science Department, said this technology is prevalent and is used in a lot of applications, including Netflix, Spotify, LinkedIn, and others. These systems find items individuals may be interested in, but have a natural tendency to promote things that are popular, which can disadvantage others. It's an interesting technical challenge, certainly, but I think it's also an obligation, Burke said. If you're building this kind of technology, you want to make sure that it's beneficial. Burke will be working alongside CU Associate Professor Amy Voida and Tulane University Assistant Professor Nick Matai in a partnership with Kiva, a nonprofit micro-lending organization that crowdfunds loans for underserved communities. Burke, who has been working with Kiva for 3 or 4 years, said the study will involve working with the nonprofit to help the organization recommend loans to users more fairly. Burke said the researchers will first try to understand fairness as a concept in the context of Kiva's mission. Researchers will conduct interviews and focus groups to help them understand what the organization's mission is. The researchers will then turn those ideas into algorithms that preserve fairness concerns while providing personalized recommendations and put the systems into practice. Jesse Smith, a PhD student at CU, said Kiva is an example of a high-stakes domain for machine learning because the platform can have real impacts for people. Smith will help conduct the interviews with Kiva employees and interpret those responses into algorithm design in the later stages of the research. If certain borrowers on the site are not recommended fairly, they could consistently become underfunded on the platform, Smith wrote in an email. Alternatively, if certain borrowers are over-recommended on the platform, they could consistently get funded over other equally deserving borrowers. The concerns for fair treatment within the machine learning application of recommendations on this platform are very real and have very real consequences to people all across the world. Smith said understanding fairness and being transparent about how algorithms impact people's lives is important in creating a more equitable future. I hope this study will help create more fair outcomes for various stakeholders of Kiva's micro-lending platform, and I also hope that it will act as a preliminary case study for operationalizing fairness in recommender systems in a real-world setting, Smith said. POLIS, New State Worker Union, agreed to raises, by Alex Burness of the Denver Post. Colorado State Employees Union and Governor Jared POLIS have agreed on a new contract that promises the more than 30,000 people who work for state government across the board raises, a minimum wage hike, and more paid time off. This is a first for the state, as the union, Colorado Winds, only recently won collective bargaining rights. That was a result of a 2020 bill that POLIS signed after scuttling a similar proposal the year prior. The union, Colorado Winds, said more than 99% of members voted to ratify the contract. Polis supported it, too, and the two sides held a news conference Thursday at the governor's mansion in Denver to mark the agreement. Every Coloradan should be able to live in and enjoy our great state of Colorado, Polis said Thursday, flanked by union leaders. We aren't just saying that we value our workers, we're showing it. For most of the past decade, and even now, state workers in Colorado have been underpaid, at times vastly so, compared with private sector workers. The average base salary for a state worker is now 6.5% lower than the prevailing market, according to a Department of Personnel and Administration report released in September. That means someone qualified for a $70,000 state job could expect to fetch close to $5,000 more for comparable work in the private sector. Skip Miller, president of the union, said at Thursday's event, "Decades of underfunding have hampered our work, but we're proud to make progress with this first contract." The contract includes 3% across-the-board raises for all state workers in 2022, 2023, and 2024, plus a new $15 minimum wage that applies to the more than 700 state workers who have been making less than that. Under the agreement, workers also will get more paid time off, including an additional state holiday on Juneteenth and 4 weeks of paid family leave, up from 2 weeks. The contract also calls for the creation of an equity, diversity, and inclusion task force to make recommendations that improve the workplace for all employees and improve access to public services for all Coloradans, the union said. Aspects of the contract that affect state budgeting, like the agreed-to raises, are still subject to approval by the legislature. But Representative Julie McCluskey, a Dillon Democrat who leads the Joint Budget Committee, said she believes the committee and the Democrat-controlled legislature generally will support the agreement. "We really believe in supporting our state workers, and we're excited," she said. "Overall, I see it as a positive step for us in the state." Voters to decide on whether to cut income taxes, by Saja Hindi of the Denver Post. Colorado voters will be asked once again if they want to reduce the state's income tax rate, this time on the November 2022 ballot. The Colorado Secretary of State's office approved Initiative 31 on Thursday, projecting that backers had submitted 118.9% of the required 124,632 valid signatures. The initiative calls for an across-the-board income tax rate cut from 4.55% to 4.40%. Voters approved a state income tax rate reduction last year, taking the income tax rate from 4.63% to 4.55%. The same backers of that proposition, Republican Senator Jerry Sonnenberg of Sterling and John Caldara of the Libertarian Independence Institute, are the ones asking voters for this cut. "It's frustrating that we have to go through this process because the legislature will not live within its means, just like every other family in Colorado," Sonnenberg said, citing fees levied for state agencies such as Colorado Parks and Wildlife. But opponents of such permanent tax reductions say they will require state government to make significant funding cuts from essential programs such as education, human services, and public safety. The Bell Policy Center, which advocates for taxpayer Bill of Rights reforms, backed a proposal in 2020 for a constitutional amendment that would tax the richest Coloradans and cut taxes for everyone else, but it did not qualify with enough signatures for the ballot that year. Executive Director Scott Wasserman pointed to the group's polling this year, which showed 61% of Coloradans wanted a fairer tax code. Colorado has to start having smarter conversations, and measures like this don't do anything but make our budget hole worse and end up hurting low- and middle-income families, he said. If voters approve Initiative 31, an income of $20,000 per year would go down about $30, while someone who makes $100,000 will see a $150 annual reduction. In the 2021 election, voters rejected all three statewide measures, including two conservative proposals for a property tax rate reduction and a requirement for all fee spending to be approved by the legislature and go through a public hearing. Sonnenberg said he heard from some constituents who found those measures confusing, but this one is straightforward. They have the option to say, you know what, government, we'll allow you to keep a little more money. I like the way you're spending the tax dollars, the money you're taking in. Or it allows taxpayers to say, I want some of my money back because you are collecting money from me that I didn't get a vote on, he said. In business news, canned cocktail maker looking at Montrose for distribution hub by Aldo Sibaldi of the Denver Post. A California distiller and brewer is considering Montrose for a new canning and distribution hub, something that economic development officials said could help employ workers left behind when Russell Stover Chocolates closed its plant there in summer 2020. The Colorado Economic Development Commission awarded the unnamed company, known as Project Chapter, $292,763 in job growth incentive tax credits, conditioned on it providing 40 net new jobs, paying an average annual wage of $53,076, which is 128% of the average annual wage in Montrose County. Reno, Nevada is also under consideration. About half of the jobs would involve production work, while the remainder would be in sales and delivery. The distiller also plans to add several additional retail jobs to staff a tasting room and restaurant, but the state did not incentivize those lower-paying positions. The company, which has 26 employees, makes canned cocktails, which are growing in popularity, as well as canned beer and distilled spirits. Commissioner Wendell Pryor noted that the state has no dearth of brewers and distillers and questioned why another one should be incentivized, but voted along with the other commissioners to approve the project. Sandy Head, executive director of the Montrose Economic Development Corporation, said the company would be an excellent addition to the city's Colorado Outdoors Industrial Park and provide jobs needed to replace some of the 289 positions that were lost when Russell Stover closed its plant. We have been taking names and have 90 individuals who are anxious to get back into food production, she said. Elsmer Education, a Denver-based education technology company that received $1.7 million in state tax credits under the name Project Norman in September, has chosen Denver over Houston for 138 new jobs, paying an average annual wage of $84,490, the Colorado Office of Economic Development and International Trade announced. Co-edit staffers also are working on a plan to allocate $95 million in federal funds under the state's Small Business Credit Initiative, which is designed to help with economic recovery efforts with a special focus on disadvantaged businesses. About $54 million could go to the state's Venture Capital Authority, with an additional $23 million targeted for Cash Collateral Support Program, which provide support for loans that lenders might otherwise consider too risky to make. About $3 million of the money could go to help back leases for early childhood education providers, which are considered a key link in getting more parents back into the workforce. CoEdit also announced Thursday that it has awarded $1.5 million in grants to 55 out of 84 applicants seeking funds to promote economic development efforts in the state. It also said that its Advanced Industries Accelerator program had awarded $6.3 million in early stage capital and retention grants to 22 Colorado companies and 5 researchers. The goal of those awards is to provide funding for promised technologies and products that can be manufactured in Colorado and exported globally. And finally, a story from the New York Times. Vials labeled smallpox are found in Pennsylvania lab. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is investigating the discovery of vials that are labeled smallpox at a laboratory in Pennsylvania, the health agency said Thursday. The frozen vials were incidentally discovered by a laboratory worker while cleaning out a freezer in a facility that conducts vaccine research in Pennsylvania. Belcy Gonzalez, a spokesperson for the CDC, said in an email Thursday. She added the CDC was working with law enforcement officials to investigate the vials. The agency said the vials appeared to be intact. The laboratory worker who discovered the vials was wearing gloves and a face mask, she said. There is no indication that anyone has been exposed to the small number of frozen vials. We will provide further details as they are available. The CDC did not say where in Pennsylvania the vials were discovered or how many there were. Mark O'Neill, a press secretary for the Pennsylvania Department of Health, said there were a small number of vials found at a Merck facility in Montgomery County outside Philadelphia. The CDC said the last natural outbreak of smallpox in the United States was in 1949. The last known natural case was in Somalia in 1977, according to the World Health Organization. The WHO said that there were 2 authorized repositories of variola virus stocks, the CDC in Atlanta and a research center in Russia. Thank you for joining us for the Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy.
Students with disabilities in Douglas County want some time after a federal judge ruled last week that a new health order making mask wearing optional in school would put students at risk of irreparable harm. But with a new conservative-leaning school board set to take over at the end of the month, that reprieve could be short-lived. David Monroe with Disability Law Colorado says if the new board decides to embrace the health order, students and families would be back at square one.
What's at stake here is the right for especially students with disabilities to have a right to get the same public education every other child does, but to get that education in an atmosphere which is safe to them, does not compromise or jeopardize their health.
Families of students with disabilities and the Douglas County School District took the county's new health department to court, arguing that making masks optional was a violation of the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. Last week, a U.S. district judge ordered the health department to stop enforcement of the order for 14 days. County health officials disagreed with the judge's decision and claimed the order strikes the right balance between public health and parental choice. Children with disabilities frequently face serious health challenges, and Monroe says many parents pulled their kids out of school during COVID surges, uncertain if mask mandates were being followed. But when kids aren't in school, Monroe says they're losing out on their right to an appropriate public education.
There are children who have had health issues that may leave them immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. They can be at a much higher risk of having a very serious health outcome if they get COVID.
Douglas County School District's president welcomed the court's temporary restraining order and said in a statement that no one should have to choose between sending their children to school and putting their health at risk. This is Eric Galatas reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. Place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Attention, Douglas County residents. Your first call for information about programs and services for seniors and adults with disabilities is 303-660-7519. That number again, 303-660-7519. This includes information about transit services, senior housing, nutrition programs and resources, financial resources, long-term care and medical resources, in-home services, and volunteer opportunities. Again, the Douglas County first call telephone number is 303-660-7519 for information about programs and services for seniors and adults with disabilities.